lot of parents wonder, well, why? COVID hasn't affected kids as much. The truth is COVID has caused more deaths. It's among the top 10 killers of kids in the last year. CDC announced it as the 8th leading killer of young people. So this is not just another thing for kids to take the hit, take one for the team. This is about protecting kids, keeping schools safe, getting back to normal. So as a pediatrician, father of four, we have a real obligation to highlight that this is about our kids.
Dr. Mark Ghaly, Secretary of California's Health and Human Services, speaking yesterday at a press conference. Any day now, the government in Washington is expected to approve the use of the Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11. California says it's ready with more than a million doses for those kids. But that doesn't mean parents are ready. And with me to talk through some of their concerns is Dr. Katherine Williamson. She's a pediatrician at Children's Hospital in Orange County. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what are you hearing from parents about whether they want to vaccinate their kids or not?
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, this is a conversation I'm having with patients' parents every day. And I will say that the majority, more than half of my patients' parents who have kids ages 5 to 11 cannot wait to protect their child with this vaccine. So that is a very common conversation we're having.
What are some of the concerns from other parents?
You know, I think that the concerns and questions have been kind of the same across the board. We were talking about, you know, kids getting vaccinated 12 and up or 5 to 11. And one of the biggest things is that everything just feels so new, right? I mean, this pandemic has been overwhelming. Science has been, you know, politicized, and the vaccine just feels like, hey, gosh, this is something brand new. Do I want to put this in, you know, do I want to put this in my child? And the truth is that, you know, we know so much about vaccines and how they work and how they protect kids. And while technically the vaccine is new, it works the same as any other vaccine out there that protects our children from diseases and sometimes fatal diseases.
Are some of the objections you're hearing from parents who have no problem getting vaccinated themselves or no problem vaccinating their older kids, but are just a little leery because the younger kids are so little?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a common question I get where parents for themselves were ready to get vaccinated, but then with kids who are not little adults and developing bodies, they want to know, is this going to have any negative impact on their development? And I think that's where it's so important to understand the science behind the vaccines. So for example, with the Pfizer vaccine, which is an mRNA vaccine, the particle that goes into our body and tells our immune system, hey, we need an army for this particular virus, that mRNA dissolves within days. So really all its job is to do is to tell our immune system to build those antibodies, and then that's what we have. We have a smarter immune system ready to be exposed, because the truth is we are all going to be exposed to the COVID-19 virus if we haven't yet.
Right. So it's a messenger, literally. It's in the name.
Mm-hmm.
It comes into your body
exactly.
And says, hey, this is how you do this. Here's my knowledge. And now I'm going to get out of here. You do your job.
Exactly. Yeah. And a common question I get from parents are, well, what about the long-term side effects, right? From a vaccine that hasn't been out very long. And while it's a really fantastic question, the truth is there's no science to be concerned about long-term side effects because, again, the mRNA is literally out of your body. And what you have is your antibodies just with a little bit more knowledge.
What about the dosage? It's not as strong as the dosage for adults, right?
Correct. So it's 30 micrograms for kids 12 and older, all the way into adults, which already at that is a very, very small dose. And the 5 to 11-year-old is 10 micrograms, so it's a third of the dose. And the reason for that is that kids' immune systems, when they're younger, is so much more robust, and it doesn't take much viral exposure to create a really good antibody army. So it's not that they can't handle or that it's unsafe to do a bigger dose. It's just that they don't need it.
And so does that mean they'll have less severe side effects when they get vaccinated?
That's the goal. Yeah, potentially having a lower dose, you're less likely to have fevers. You're less likely to be achy. So that's what we're hoping to see. And that's one of the things we're seeing with the trials.
So what do you say to parents who say, you know, yeah, okay, I've heard all of this and still, you know, it's not that likely that my kid will get seriously ill if they get COVID. So I think I'm just going to wait.
Yeah, well, you know, we know that the children are less likely to get a serious disease from COVID, but it's not benign. And I think that that's the part that the parents really need to realize is that your child might be one of the lucky ones who are asymptomatic, but as a pediatrician, I've seen so many kids who have had serious disease, and there are many children who have died from the COVID virus. It is time to protect them, and I tell parents, you know, it's just not worth the risk.
So why isn't this available for all kids, even the youngest, from 0 to 4?
So those trials have not been completed yet. So, you know, a testament to the safety of vaccines is that nothing is released until we have enough studies. We have enough data for those studies. And it goes through all the proper channels to make sure that the best of the scientists we have approve those studies and agree that it is safe. So once it goes through that process, and we're hoping sometime next week that we will get that approval for 5 to 11, then that happens. And so we just need more time until the younger than 5-year-old vaccine gets released and is shown to be safe and effective.
And how often are you having these conversations with parents of your patients?
Every day, all the time. I saw a number of patients this morning, and it was definitely a topic of conversation.
And what are you seeing in terms of other childhood diseases? Are you seeing more or less of them as, you know, parents and kids are taking precautions with masking at schools and things like that?
Yeah, you would think with the masking that kids wouldn't be getting sick, right? But it's happening. So we are definitely in the middle of cold season. I mean, RSV, which is a common winter virus, which we didn't see a whole lot last year because kids weren't in school and kids weren't gathering, that hit this summer. Influenza is already out there. It came early as well. It came in August, as well as a number of other colds. So, you know, we know that, yes, masking helps to reduce the risk of spread and hand washing and continue to do that, but it doesn't prevent all spread. And we know that because kids are still getting sick and kids are still getting COVID.
Dr. Catherine Williamson is a pediatrician at Children's Hospital in Orange County. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, what will the United States bring to the global climate summit next week? And can other big polluters like China step up their game? That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. President Biden left for Europe earlier today. He's attending the major global climate summit in Glasgow next week. But he left D.C. with his entire climate agenda on the line as Democrats scramble to agree on a major social spending package. The bill still includes clean energy tax credits, a New Deal-style civilian climate corps, and investments in the supply chain. But it is significantly less ambitious than Biden's original climate proposal. And even this stripped-down version, well, it might not survive. We're going to talk about what's in this plan as it stands now with Pasha Madavi. He is a political scientist at UC Santa Barbara who studies energy and environmental politics. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right, $555 billion for climate change. That's what's in this bill. So it is the biggest slice of the nearly $2 trillion pie. What do you make of that? That sounds like a lot of money. It sounds like an ambitious amount to do a lot of good.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just with that in mind, it is undeniably a win for climate policy. As you said, it is the biggest slice of the pie. And it does go a long way, not all the way, right? In making up for the loss of the Clean Electricity Performance Program, or the CEPP, which was axed 2 weeks ago by the Senate. And by that, I mean, it is effectively paving the way for more than 1 gigaton of pollution cuts. It's almost making up for the parts that CEPP would have done. But we've got to keep in mind that this needs to pass, right? It is not done. And it's not done until it's on the president's desk. And a refrain going around right now is that Democrats need to hold the line, not move the infrastructure bill first until both of these are sent to the White House, right? So this is a great proposal, but we don't have bill text quite yet.
Right. Okay. So what you mentioned, the CEPP, that was the proposal that would have incentivized utilities to switch to clean energy. And it was axed basically because Joe Manchin, who represents West Virginia and coal interests, said no, he wouldn't go along with it, with that in it. That was, wasn't it, the heart of this entire proposal?
That's correct. And just to be clear, the CEPP was a mandate effectively for utilities to generate a certain amount of clean electricity by a set date. It's effectively the idea with it. But, you know, the $320 billion out of this $550 billion in tax credits will help to make up for much of the emissions cuts that would have resulted from CEPP. Because by itself, just CEPP would have cut about 20 to 35% of the total emissions cuts that we had in the plan by 2030. So it's not the knockout punch for climate that we need. But as one of my colleagues here at UCSB, Dr. Leah Stokes, has said, you know, these incentives, they're going to be a big start that can be followed up with more action later. So it is a big step, but it is not the knockout punch that we had hoped for.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the details in these incentives. One plan is to give people who buy electric cars subsidies, and by some estimates, pretty hefty subsidies. I saw one for $12,500 a family could save if they bought an electric car.
That's right. So that's part of that first slice, that big chunk of $320 billion, these clean energy tax credits, right? These are not just for the EVs, right? This includes the utility scale renewables, but this electrification focused rebate program, that's what this 12,500 savings is kind of a part of. This is all packaged as a way to allow middle-class homeowners to switch to electrify appliances, to affordably install rooftop solar, and to purchase EVs, right? Because a lot of the credits are running out, and we've got to ramp up EVs as part of a general market share. So that is, it is a big part of that $320 billion, but let's not forget, you know, the rest of the money that's in there for utility scale, as well as other components of residential clean energy. And the savings that are estimated for the average American family are some.
Okay, you just cut out there.
These savings.
What were the
for
savings?
That average household.
I'm sorry, you just cut out there. What were the savings?
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
No problem. The savings are estimated to be about hundreds of dollars per year for the average American family.
Okay.
Right? That's kind of the on average estimate.
But meanwhile, there needs to be a larger plan put in place for utilities, for large polluters, not just at the individual level. So what does this plan, not include that needs to be included aside from what was already cut out that we just discussed? But is there some way for Biden to make this up in a different way?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that is next on the chopping block, or really the, as we would say, kind of the fate of it is unknown, is this issue of methane pollution in particular, and just in general, oil and gas industry decarbonization. That's not really in this plan. And, you know, the methane fees question that's probably going to be axed out of the infrastructure bill, that may not be a bad thing given some of the questionable effectiveness of these kinds of fees without enforcement. So what can Biden do instead? Well, we need a lot better monitoring and enforcement of existing regulations on pollution. right? And regulations across the entire oil sector. So the EPA is working on this, right? That's part of the purview outside of Congress. And this is a big area because this is the kind of pollution, you know, methane leakage, for example, coming out of pipelines, coming out of oil facilities. That's a huge component of the oil industry's operational climate impact. Because we know methane in particular, it's a lot more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, but it extends kind of beyond and across the sector. Lots of things that you can do on the executive side in terms of enforcement, better monitoring for regulations that we already have.
Well, and thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Pasha Madavi. He's a political scientist at UC Santa Barbara, where he studies energy and environmental politics. I want to zoom out now and look ahead to Glasgow with Somini Sengupta. She's an international climate reporter with the New York Times. Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, let's talk about this climate meeting. It's known as COP26. And why is this meeting billed as more important than previous year's conferences? 26 is basically meaning the 26th one.
It's the 26th session of what's called the Conference of Parties, hence COP, to the UN framework for climate change. So here's the larger context of this. In 2015, the US was pretty instrumental in getting all countries on board and getting the Paris Climate Agreement done. And that Paris Climate Agreement said, okay, we know this is a problem. It's affecting countries all over the world. We know we need to collectively slow down the warming that's already occurred, mm-hmm. that is occurring. And we have to do that by slowing down emissions. And in the case of rich industrialized countries who are responsible for most of these emissions, we need to start cutting them really fast. So that's the Paris Agreement in 2015.
Yeah.
Then President Trump came in, pulled the United States out of the Paris Agreement. Then President Biden came in, put the United States back in the Paris Agreement, and very quickly came out with a pretty ambitious climate plan for the United States to roughly cut the US emissions by half by 2030. And what your previous guest was talking about, you know, the question is, well, is the US going to be able to deliver the legislation required to cut emissions? And that remains, as your guest was saying, still an outstanding question. Mm-hmm. Let's see what Congress can get done by the time Biden appears on the stage in Glasgow.
Well, time is running out because that's next week. So I'm wondering, as you're looking at the plan now and what stayed and what was cut out, if it is enough to meet some of the goals that he set out and some of the goals from Paris.
These are really ambitious goals that the U.S. has set out. It's not going to, rise and fall on one piece of legislation. But certainly for US credibility on the international stage, it's imperative for this administration to be able to show that it can, get things done. But it is very clear that there are domestic political constraints, there are economic constraints. And that incidentally applies not just to the United States, but to other major polluters. So today came another important piece of news from China, from Beijing, about what it plans to do to address climate change. And the announcement was pretty low on ambition. Beijing's latest climate action plan basically reiterates what President Xi Jinping said almost a year ago, that China plans to continue to grow its emissions of greenhouse gases. Mainly comes in the Chinese case from burning coal, lots and lots of coal. China plans to continue to do that until roughly 2030, but it intends to reach peak emissions before 2030, and it intends to include renewable energies as about 25% of its total energy mix. You know, these kinds of commitments are well below what many people were expecting from China, and it casts a bit of an omen on the climate talks that begin next week.
That is really disheartening, as you put it, and even noting that the Chinese president, President Xi, is not even going to be there at the summit next week.
That is less than that is less surprising, because President Xi has not traveled outside China since the coronavirus pandemic really began. So he is expected to make an address remotely. We don't really know yet. But look, what counts is what major polluter countries are willing to do and are doing right now. And by major polluter countries, really, it's the world's 20 largest economies. It's the G20, and they are meeting this weekend, right before the climate conference begins. And the biggest polluting countries among them are the United States, China, countries of the European Union, Russia, India, Mexico, Indonesia, you know, sort of large economies in different degrees, certainly. And so what these countries are willing to do in the next few years, not by 2050, not by 2060, but really between now and 2030, is what's going to make a difference for all of us.
Right. Well, I mean, there are still baked in changes no matter what the world does. Isn't that correct? I mean, there will still be effects from global warming that we can't address. That's, you know, that's just going to happen.
The context is this: since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, countries in Europe and the United States, other industrialized nations, have been burning lots and lots of fossil fuels. That has already warmed up the global average temperature by a little above 1 degree Celsius. So we're already warmer on average than we were 150 years ago. And we're seeing the effects of that in the form of extreme weather events. We're seeing the effects of that in the form of wildfires in California, extreme storms and flooding events in Europe, not to mention sea level rise that takes really a terrifying toll on low-lying countries from Bangladesh to Fiji and other places. So we're seeing the effects of climate change already. And the scientific consensus, emphasis on consensus, there really is very little debate about this, but the scientific consensus is once global average temperature rise gets above 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to the pre-industrial age, then the likelihood of really bad things increases much more.
Right.
So that's the challenge, you know, before us.
Is to
cutting
keep it
emissions
there.
Is to keep it there to, within,
1.5. We're already at one. So, okay. Samini Sengupta, international climate reporter for the New York Times. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, there is a new Superman, and he's bisexual.
We could go so many different directions. We can use our imagination. We can do so many cool things with these characters that can bring representation in new and exciting ways. And we've kind of limited ourselves in the past.
Why superheroes and queerness are a natural pairing. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier this month, DC Comics revealed a plot twist for its new Superman comic books. The twist? Superman is bisexual. The character is actually a new Superman, the son of Clark Kent and Lois Lane. His name is John Kent, and just like his dad, he falls in love with a reporter. But in this series, the reporter is a guy. The comic comes out next month. Many fans have said a leading queer character is a welcome and long overdue addition. But the writer and advice columnist John Paul Bremer says it's kind of strange that Superman was straight to begin with. And he joins me now. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, you're talking about the OG Superman. You don't think he should have been straight to begin with.
People seem pretty upset with that line. I thought it was a funny little joke. I was just saying that when talking about aliens, for example, we've always sort of mapped human features, human sexuality onto them, which is kind of weird to do with aliens. It's kind of funny that Superman, who hails from planet Krypton, happens to be heterosexual, happens to look a whole lot like a European. I don't think he should have had a kind of human sexuality anyway. If I was in charge, I think he should have been some sort of weird alien who reproduced by spores or something. But the point I'm trying to make is just that for the longest time, we have sort of mapped the dominant cultural norms, for better or for worse, onto our superheroes. And so it is a really big deal when you move it in a different direction and you take someone like Superman, who's supposed to represent sort of like the paragon of what a man should be, and you change his sexuality a little bit. Because again, we're not actually dealing with aliens here. We're dealing with human beings making comics for other human beings. Mm-hmm. And so the politics that go into that are very interesting. And I'm not raging against the institution of Superman. I know that's very tempting for a lot of people to think I'm doing, because I happen to be gay talking about LGBT representation in comics, which I'm sure some people would take umbrage with. But I'm more just observing, you know, we could go so many different directions. We can use our imagination. We can do so many cool things with these characters that can bring representation in new and exciting ways. And we've kind of limited ourselves in the past.
Yeah. And it sounds like we're limiting ourselves now because the son of Superman is bisexual. So it's kind of like having a toe in both waters.
Well, I think it's cool that he's bi, because I think that there's a huge bisexual community and we often don't get them in comics, movies, TV shows, etc. What I think is more of the half measure is just that in comic books, you have multiverses and people don the suit at different times, not just with Superman, but with Marvel as well. It's sort of like you can have a new Captain America, or you can have a new Thor. You can have a parallel universe where there's a different Thor, and this time he looks different, or this time Thor is a woman, which is kind of cool and all, but it's also a really easy way to get the representation you want without having to sacrifice anything or make any huge decisions that could impact the main core of the project. So, for example, maybe you can just make a parallel universe where some superhero is bi or gay instead of straight, and you can call it a day from there. So it's not like as huge a deal, I think, as people think it is, but it's still a really cool change.
Yeah. Well, you wrote in your op-ed in the Washington Post that LGBTQ people have long read themselves into comics. Like, it's sort of natural for them to see themselves as one of these superheroes because they are, they're ostracized, they're sort of outsiders, and they have secret identities.
Yeah, and I think, too, that just the culture around being super into comic books, it's very popular nowadays, mainstream, I guess I would say, but it was such a nerdy subculture back in the day, and I think that anywhere you find people who are kind of ostracized for their interests or who have had to form little communities on the fringes of what we would consider the dominant culture, you're going to find a lot of symmetry with the LGBT experience. Not quite identical, but there is definitely some symmetry there, and I think that in the past, LGBTQ readers have really taken to comic books because of those themes of being an outsider, because of having a secret identity, or just because these are often characters struggling to negotiate their identities with the world around them. And those are very resonant themes. I think specifically of the X-Men, for example, mm-hmm. which has a huge LGBTQ fan base. It's always been the case, and not just in terms of in the comic books themselves, but in the nerd culture, I think, that surrounded them.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite character?
Well, I'm told that when I was little, I was very into Batman. I know he's not actually a superhero. I had like a Batman cake and I had a Batman toys when I was very little. And then I immediately, like after that year, stopped, got super into dinosaurs and stopped thinking about superheroes at all. And I only recently started looking at them again because it feels like they're quite inescapable, actually. The Marvel Cinematic Universe, there's so many people who are into them that just as a person who's interested in culture, I was like, okay, I guess I should start watching these movies. So I'm dipping my toes in, so to speak.
Well, speaking of Batman, I always thought that he had a very close relationship with Robin, and now Robin apparently has a bisexual storyline.
Yeah, that is one that I would also go back in time and be like, yeah, I think this is a pretty queer relationship here. I think that Robin has always sort of been this gay icon. I always see on Twitter that one movie back in the day where Robin had the really skin tight suit and gay men are always like, this was my sexual awakening. So I think that Robin has always sort of been there as this loose representation for gay people, but that's kind of how we've always been. We've always had to kind of read ourselves into it with subtext. We've never really had a whole lot of explicit text that is dedicated to saying, yes, this character is gay, this character is bi, etc. Mm-hmm. And I think you're only recently seeing things like that. We've had LGBT characters in comics before, but never to the extent we have now. And it's still not a whole lot, but it's still a very welcome sign.
Okay, so those are comic books. And on TV now, there's Loki on Disney Plus, and that's a Marvel character who comes out as bisexual. He's played by Tom Hiddleston, and here's a clip.
You're a prince. Must have been would-be princesses. Or perhaps another prince.
A bit of both. I suspect the same as you. But nothing ever...
real.
Okay. So that's how he came out. Did they dive deeper with this storyline?
No, they don't really focus on it. And they don't make it a very big deal. And this is also a situation where there's a multiverse Loki. So there's also a Loki where he's an alligator. Oh. It seems to be the case that for a lot of these things, you have to really be paying attention. You have to really hone in on the details. And again, that sort of harkens back to a tradition in the LGBTQ community of just constantly looking for little signs like this that tell them, yes, okay, there is a queer reading of this character. But I'm also very reluctant to outright celebrate or applaud things like this because I think that Marvel specifically has such a huge international reach, and for them to be doing kind of so little in comparison to what they're giving us, I think that it's not the time to really roll out the parade for Marvel or any comic book series for that matter. But again, I'm not complaining. I'm very happy that they are continuing at a pace to roll out more LGBTQ characters. It's just one of those situations where it doesn't match with just how many LGBTQ readers there are out there of that content.
Right. What about women? Like, doesn't Wonder Woman come from a land of women? And I mean,
yeah, I think that for women as well, it's kind of a similar situation where you often have women in comic books who are in the fandom and they are often not thought of. They're often not as catered to. A lot of the characters, it's gotten better, but obviously in the past, there's that enduring critique of how sexualized the women characters have been and sort of prepared for the male gaze. And so I think that comics, just like anywhere, any other cultural arena, is having similar reckonings where it's just like, okay, how do we make this better? How do we take the right steps? How do we empower our faithful readers who've been here all along, who maybe we've been letting down? And I think that it is women and LGBTQ people working within comic books and cinema that are sort of making those changes and pushing the envelope. And it's really cool to see, even though I do think there is a creeping Marvel factor where it's just like, God, they're everywhere. They have such a stranglehold on movies and the money going into cinema. So there's good and there's bad involved. Mm,
yeah. Well, I mean, especially with comic books, I think, you know, this is where a lot of kids retreat to who feel overwhelmed maybe by being kids and all the pressures of growing up. And it's really kind of a safe place to explore themselves in different viewpoints and different identities. So it's really interesting that a lot of this can take place within the pages of a comic book. and they can be more daring than TV shows or movies.
Absolutely. And I think that's really the power of fiction. Your imagination can really run wild. And I think that the point I'm kind of making with my piece is just that, you know, we're dealing with a fictional universe where we can dream big, we can think big. And within the confines of that prompt, we haven't done as much as we could have. We are still very much restricting ourselves to the world around us when I think we could maybe look to the stars and dream even bigger. And I think that that is a goal that any of us who are creators should really strive for. Don't restrict yourself to just what you've been served up time and time again when you have the opportunity to do something cool, do something that could really charter a new path, that could really bring people into the script and into the text that have previously been excluded. Because if the sky's the limit, then that's where we should go.
Hmm. If you could be any superhero, who would it be?
You know, honestly, I like Wonder Woman's invisible plane. I think that's cool. I want that. I want the lasso that makes people tell the truth. I no longer want to be Batman where he has, like, there's too much technique involved with being Batman. I just kind of want to have my little powers and I want them to work for me. And I don't want to have to practice karate at the base of a mountain to learn how to do them.
Yeah, I mean, it's stressful being Batman.
Yeah, it's so stressful.
Who needs it?
Not me. I want my invisible plane.
Exactly. Take me away. John Paul Braemer. He is the writer of the advice column and memoir Hola Papi. And you can read his piece on superheroes in the Washington Post. It's been great to have you back, John Paul. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here to celebrate Day of the Dead in food and why some tigers at the San Diego Zoo got breakthrough COVID infections. Yeah, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, Dia de los Muertos is almost here. That's the two-day Mexican holiday to remember and celebrate the dead with offerings of flowers, sugar skulls, and, of course, food. Evan Kleiman is host of KCRW's Good Food, and she's here with some ideas for what to do and what to eat this Dia de los Muertos. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, so two whole days to feast. And I love this holiday for the visuals, the marigolds, just the bright colors, the sugar skulls, and of course, all of the costumes and the face painting. It just seems like such a joyful holiday, even though it is about celebrating the dead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think of all of the funerary customs there are in the world, there's something about the Day of the Dead that is so life-affirming at the same time that it is calling the spirits of loved ones you really miss back to you.
And so you have these altars where you place the marigolds and a picture of the person that you want to honor, and then you put some food offerings. What are some of the food offerings?
Well, I think the food offerings are usually based around what the people that you're honoring loved the most. So I'm making an altar to my dog husband, Paco.
Oh, Paco, who used to appear on this segment from time to time.
Yes, he did. And so, you know, I'm putting a few of his, like, little pieces of chicken and which I will, of course, consume before it goes bad. Yeah. But I'm going to put some of his treats on the altar. And I think that's one of the greatest parts of this particular celebration, is that you really think about what it is that animated their spirit and what they enjoyed. And it inevitably leads to talking about them, laughing, crying a little bit, of course.
Yeah. And then is there a larger meal associated with it as well?
I think that depends on the family. I know traditionally in Mexico, when people gather at the cemeteries, that they basically bring picnics and will share a meal with the spirits. I think here in LA, there probably are families that do that, but I think more and more people gather at events, which, you know, host performances of all kinds and food of all kinds, much like any kind of public festival would.
Well, one annual event, which is fantastic, is at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. And actually, it's a day and nighttime event. Like, there are two separate times you can go. And there's all sorts of stuff going on there. All the altars on the grave sites are really incredible. But there's also a lot of food. So what kinds of food can we expect this year?
Well, at Hollywood Forever, they have really gone all out on bringing in a lot of taco purveyors that we really love. So some of the vendors that will be there include Carnitas El Artista, Coney Seafood, who we, of course, all love, Don Cuco, Pablito's Taco, Pez Cantina, Evil Cooks, and Machin Tacos.
And then there's another event at Self Help Graphics and Art in East LA.
Right. It's their 48th year of marking the Day of the Dead. And they are, in fact, the oldest public celebration in Los Angeles. And much like the activities at Hollywood Forever, they have all kinds of performances. They do a parade. And they've been working with the Vendedores en Acción, which is a street activist group, to furnish the food for their event.
Give us an example or two.
Don Faustino, who's been written up in the LA Times, he is a frozen treat vendor. He's going to have bolis, which are a lot like Otter Pops, and chocolate-covered bananas. Juan Ponce, Iván Ponce, and Esmeralda doing aguas en champurrado. Champurrado is a hot drink made of chocolate and masa. They also have Yolanda Granados, who's coming with some tamales and esquites. There are quite a few different ones.
Ooh, that sounds so good. Okay, and so what about making your own? Do you have a recipe for us today?
Of course I do. You know, we've been talking about Day of the Dead celebration and food for so many years on Good Food that we've acquired a couple recipes. And the one to try, I think, is Chef Carlos Salgado's Pan de Muerto. The Pan de Muerto is their traditional pan dulce, or sweet bread of the holiday. It's made like a little bun with these bone-shaped little cylinders of dough that go over the top. They're delicious. And another really interesting traditional sweet for the holiday, because of the time of year, of course, is candied pumpkin. And I'll have a recipe link for you on the website.
Candied pumpkin? I've never heard of such a thing.
Oh, it's so good.
What is it? Is it actual pieces of pumpkin or like fake pumpkin?
No. It's pieces of pumpkin. You can use pumpkin or any other kind of squash, like a kabocha or a butternut squash. And there's two ways of making it. One way is basically you're just steaming it and cooking it with sugar at the bottom of the pan. And then as the water evaporates, the syrup forms also with the juices of the pumpkin. And you end up with a very soft candied mixture that sometimes falls apart, but people like eating it anyway in a bowl, maybe with some milk. But the way to make it so the pieces are actually candied is you first soak your peeled and seeded squash pieces in hydrated lime and water. And in the pumpkin, what it does is it deletes some of the water and allows the sugar syrup to enter the fibers of the pumpkin without it falling apart.
Aha. Okay. Well, thank you for that clarification. What if you just want to buy some good pan de muerto? Where would you go?
There's a really wonderful bakery in Long Beach called Gusto Bread that is unusual for Southern California because Arturo Enciso, who is the head baker and the owner, uses sourdough, a masa madre, as it's called in Spanish, to make not only traditional European breads that we're used to seeing made with sourdough, but also all these different Mexican breads, including pan dulce. And they're making some special things for the holiday.
Okay, and the celebrations that we mentioned at Hollywood Forever Cemetery and Self Help Graphics, those are both taking place this Saturday.
Yes, and they're ticketed. So we have links for you on the website so you can learn everything you need to know about either of those events.
All right, check all of that out at kcrw.com. Evan Kleinman is host of KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear Saturdays at 11 a.m. And Evan, you're doing an Instagram Live next week?
That's right. I'm so excited. It's my first Instagram Live, and I'm doing it with my friend and colleague, Genevieve Coe, who is cooking editor at the New York Times. And we're asking people to submit their questions to us in advance, if they can, by emailing us at goodfood@kcrw.org. Of course, during the live, we'll also be answering live questions. It's going to be at 12 noon Pacific for 1 hour on Thursday.
That sounds very instructive and entertaining. Evan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, before we let you go, we have another entry in our occasional series, Press Pause. Three tigers at the San Diego Zoo are feeling a little under the weather. They have a mild case of COVID. All three were fully vaccinated. The zoo vaccinated hundreds of animals this summer. These are the first COVID cases the zoo has reported since that vaccination drive. And joining us to talk about this is Dr. Janessa Jeltema. She's a professor of zoological medicine at UC Davis and head vet at the Sacramento Zoo. Hi.
Hi there, Madeline. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So how did these tigers get breakthrough cases? Do you know?
So I can't speak to these specific cases. That would be a question for the San Diego Zoo folks. But what I can say is that we do know that different species are susceptible to infection in different ways. So the virus can enter body tissues based on how easily they can bind to receptors in the host. And depending on what species an animal is, they might have differently shaped receptors to allow, that allows the virus to attach and enter the body either more easily or, you know, with more challenge.
So are cats more vulnerable in general?
So it seems like they are more likely to potentially be infected. And what we do know is that there's a variety of different factors that go into that to an individual host being infected. And that includes not only the receptor shapes, but also potential levels of exposure to the virus. So maybe an animal is in an environment where it's able to contact viral particles more easily or more particles than other animals. But there can also be individual health factors that play a role as well that can make an animal more susceptible to infection.
Just like humans.
Just like humans.
And speaking of humans, would they get infected from humans?
So we suspect in a lot of the cases in zoological institutions that the infection is, you know, in our zoo species, potentially coming from, you know, people. So we do take protective measures to reduce the amount of contact some of our potentially susceptible animals might have with people. So things like social distancing, we can actually do that with tigers or other animals that might be susceptible to infection. And so we can help sort of, you know, provide more space and put up barriers, use masks and protective equipment to help protect
masks
those
masks well, on for the animals
for the
For the people,
okay, good.
Working with those animals, yeah, they would wear masks. It's really hard to coax a tiger to wear a mask, and I don't think I'd want to be the one to do that. So, but yeah, of course, we as people can wear masks and help protect the animals that we might be working with.
So I guess you have to put a swab up a tiger's nose to see if it has COVID in the first place, right? Is that how you test?
Yeah, so there's different ways of testing animals for the virus. Sometimes we might take samples of blood. Sometimes we might take swabs. And sometimes we can use, feces to test for virus. So it just depends on the particular species and, what diagnostic the veterinarian thinks is going to be most helpful for the questions that they're trying to answer.
So they expect these three tigers to pull through, right? It's not necessarily a fatal case of COVID.
So, I don't know any of the specifics related to the San Diego Zoo case, and I can't speak to that. What I would say is that it sounds they've reported there are mild signs associated with this current infection, but we are all, the zoo community, I think, is all hoping for a swift recovery.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, get well, tigers. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Janessa Jeltema, professor of zoological medicine at UC Davis. And that does it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.